This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Debbie Elliott. 50 years ago this week, on an Alabama bus, Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat to a white man. The action led to the Montgomery bus boycott and eventually ended segregation on city buses. But in the state which fostered the civil rights movement, public transportation is now minimal. As NPR's Kathy Lohr reports, citizens who benefited from Rosa Parks' action now face their own struggles with bus service.
This week's celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Montgomery bus boycott is a symbol for people across the country of how far cities have come since 1955. In Montgomery, Alabama, thousands of children, black and white, walked together downtown, marching to the state capitol in honor of Rosa Parks and the gains of the civil rights movement. Patricia Wilson was one of those who walked with the children. She says conditions are better across the country than in Alabama.
Sometimes it seems that everything that was fought for, as far as the buses are concerned, is just gone down the drain, in a sense. Because, so many people fought for this, for the buses, but it's not being carried out.
Alabama is one of only 5 states that does not fund its public transportation systems. The reason dates back to 1932, when the president of General Motors created a national group to lobby state legislatures. They wanted all gas taxes and road revenue to pay for building and maintaining roads and bridges. In 1952, Alabamians passed a constitutional amendment to do just that. For several years, a coalition of community groups known as Alabama Arise has been trying to change this in the legislature.
Response has not been particularly good.
Ron Gilbert is a policy analyst with Alabama Arise. Last year, a bill to get a measure on the ballot finally made it through committee, but failed to go any further.
Public transportation is a serious problem. It's a little unique when you've got a rural state like we have here in terms of trying to get folks to basic services they might need, to a doctor's office, to the grocery store, to a job. So we have really unique special problems, we think, here in Alabama in terms of transportation, and have a system that's not responsive to the needs of the people.
As of 2000, about 1.3 million people who live in rural Alabama had no access to public transit at all. In Montgomery, there are about a dozen routes, but one problem for those riding the system comes down to being able to get from point A to point B on time, especially when it involves transferring buses. Tisha Lumpkin is rushing to get home before her youngest daughter arrives from school, but the bus she's riding is behind schedule, so she's counting on the driver to help her make her connection.
You have to call in and ask the bus to wait, see if the bus will wait or if it's not already gone, because it leaves. From downtown, the bus I got to get on leave about 35 minutes after the hour, and it's already 30 minutes after the hour.
But the connecting second bus will not wait. Lumpkin finds out she'll miss it, and she will have to wait an hour for the next one, leaving her first grader at home alone, and Lumpkin shaken.
She's not going to know we're not there until she try to get in, so she's going to probably panic a little bit. I hope she go to the office and sit in the manager's office, but I don't know what she's gonna do. She's never been locked out before. So that's my main concern. I'm worried about my little baby, that's all.
Lumpkin has epilepsy and cannot drive. Others are concerned about the bus routes. Some have to walk half a mile or more just to catch the bus. And George Willis, an older man carrying several bags from the grocery store, rushes onto the bus and sits down. He is furious about the schedules.
In Mrs. Todd's memory, they need to run these buses better than this. This is ridiculous. You'd freeze if it was real cold out there. You would freeze. I'm 66 years old. They ran these buses every 30 minutes before the boycott. They ran them on Sundays. They ran them till 11 o'clock at night.
On most routes now, the last bus is at 6 o'clock. Those who support state funding of public transportation say next year may be their year to change the law. With the 50th anniversary of the bus boycott in mind, Alabama Arise is pushing the Jubilee Amendment to allow some state revenue to be used for public transit. Even then, the measure would still have to be approved by the voters of Alabama. Kathy Lohr, NPR News.
And now another story about buses, this one from Denver, where a Colorado woman is taking on the Department of Homeland Security. Deborah Davis says federal guards boarded the public bus she was riding and asked her to show identification. She refused and now faces federal misdemeanor charges. And every weekday, the guards continue boarding the same bus and asking other passengers to show their ID. NPR's Jeff Brady has our report.
Bus Route 100 runs through the middle of a sprawling complex of government office buildings called the Denver Federal Center. At the entrance, the bus stops. A guard, contracted to the Department of Homeland Security, boards and asks everyone for their identification.
Everybody's IDs, please.
Riders hold up their ID as the guard walks through the bus aisle.
Thank you.
The entire process takes less than a minute. Rider Eddie Warren says he doesn't like to show his ID to the guards.
Well, since you're on a public transportation, I don't see why you should have to be required. You're not asking to go into the federal center. You know, you're trying to get home to work, so I don't see why it's necessary for you to show ID.
But Warren says he does show his ID because he doesn't want to cause problems and make himself late for work. Guards check IDs for about 2,000 people a day, and they've been doing that for 10 years, since the Oklahoma City bombing. Deborah Davis was the first to refuse.
That morning, Monday morning, I got on the bus, and the guard asked me for my ID, if I had an ID, and I said yes. And he said, can I see it? And I said, no. And he said, well, then you have to get off. And I said, no, I'm not going to get off.
Davis decided to defend what is an important principle to her. Checkpoints don't belong on public bus routes in a free country. She was arrested and cited for failing to obey the signs that tell visitors to the federal center that they may be asked to show ID. She says she didn't want to get off at the center. She was just taking a public bus to get to a destination on the other side. And guards barely even look at the IDs. So she wonders how this is making the federal center more secure.
It was more like a lesson in compliance because they didn't take my ID. They didn't write down any names. They didn't compare my ID to any kind of a no-ride list, which doesn't exist.
Dennis O'Connor is with a Department of Homeland Security agency called the Federal Protective Service, which guards the Denver Federal Center. He says requiring identification does provide some security.
The first layer, it's a minor layer of security, but it does give us interaction with the people to begin with.
If someone behaves oddly, guards might pick up on that during the brief encounter. O'Connor says his agency has the difficult job of balancing two competing interests, the safety of employees in the federal center and the right of the public to ride the bus through it.
Showing of ID is the minimal inconvenience that is possible while still fulfilling those two needs.
O'Connor says the FPS began requiring ID about 10 years ago.
The complex was designed prior to the Oklahoma City bombing. And after the bombing, each of our facilities received an in-depth security evaluation. And after that evaluation, it was determined that the best way to secure that facility was to make it a closed facility.
O'Connor says the government could have forced buses to go around the 670-acre office park, but that would have inconvenienced thousands of people. O'Connor says it made more sense to allow buses to run through the center as long as guards were allowed to board each time to check IDs. The American Civil Liberties Union has taken up Deborah Davis's case. Her lawyer, Gail Johnson, says the government security guards violated her client's right to freedom of movement and her right to be protected from unreasonable searches.
We don't think there's any valid federal law that requires passengers on a public bus to show their identification in order to travel on that public bus.
Davis's case comes as a California man is challenging requirements that passengers show ID for domestic flights. His case is before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals next week. Davis is scheduled for arraignment in federal court in Denver next Friday. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
On this day in 1947, an audience at New York's Ethel Barrymore Theater witnessed the Broadway premiere of what would later be voted the best play of the 20th century.
Hiya, Blanche.
Here I am, all freshly bathed and scented and feeling like a brand new human being.
Jessica Tandy was Blanche DuBois, the fallen and fading Southern belle created by Tennessee Williams in A Streetcar Named Desire. Blanche travels to New Orleans to visit her sister, Stella, and her brute husband, Stanley Kowalski, played by the young and incredibly hot Marlon Brando.
Blanche,
In the state of Louisiana, there's such a thing as the Napoleonic Code, according to which whatever belongs to my wife is also mine and vice versa.
Oh, cards on the table. Well, that suits me. I know I fib a good deal. After all, a woman's charm is 50% illusion. But when a thing is important, I tell the truth. And this is the truth. I haven't cheated my sister. Nor you, nor anyone else, as long as I...
All right, where are the papers? In your trunk?
Everything I own is in that trunk.
After the show that opening night 58 years ago, theatergoers were stunned. After a moment of shocked silence, they clapped for 30 minutes. The generation that lived through World War II is filled with lives swept up in the turbulent winds of history. Two such lives are the subject of a new book by Vikram Seth, the acclaimed novelist whose books include An Equal Music and Golden Gate. Seth's new book is part memoir, part biography, and part history. It's called Two Lives. Tom Vitale has our report.
Vikram Seth was 17 years old when he left India in 1969 to live with his mother's uncle and aunt in London while he studied at Oxford. The couple, Shanti and Henny, had settled into a middle-class life of gardening and bridge parties. But Seth writes that even the most ordinary-seeming life can yield a rich and complex story.
Behind every door on every ordinary street, in every hut, in every ordinary village on this middling planet of a trivial star, such riches are to be found.
Seth's great-uncle and aunt were an unlikely couple. Shanti was a short, dark-skinned Hindu, born in colonial India and educated in Nazi Germany, where he studied dental surgery. When the Nazis made it difficult for him to work, he emigrated to England. As a student in Berlin, Shanti lived with the family of Henny Caro, the woman he later married. Henny was a tall, fair-skinned German Jew who escaped to London just before the war. Her mother and sister were less fortunate. They died in concentration camps. Seth says he began his memoir 11 years ago, at his own mother's suggestion, when he complained that he had nothing to write about.
My mother said, "Stop making a fuss. Why don't you interview Shanti uncle? A lot of family lore will die when he dies, and besides, it'll give him something to do." So at first it began rather as a chore, rather than something born of deep-seated inspiration or even of family duty. But now... As I started interviewing him, I became more and more fascinated.
Seth was fascinated by the personal perspective that his uncle's story provided on historic events. For instance, the description of the prolonged and bloody Battle of Monte Cassino in Italy, where Shanti was stationed as a dental surgeon in the British Army, when a German shell blew his right arm off.
It was the first time he had seen sustained warfare at close hand. He learned when a major attack was to take place by noticing when the hygiene department, which had to estimate how many men were going to die, began to dig trenches in the rocky soil as a provisional resting place for bodies before burial later, possibly much later, in a cemetery. The presence of clergymen was also a good indicator of when battle was about to begin.
Seth says when he started the book, he knew even less about his great-aunt Henny, who never spoke, even to her husband, about what the Nazis did to her family. But then the author discovered a cobweb-covered trunk in the attic, filled with copies of Henny's letters written before she married Shanti. In July 1948, after learning about the death of her mother and sister, she wrote to her former employer in Berlin.
"It is true that all of us have to die one day, whether we are rich or poor, and irrespect of religion or thought. And as the poet puts it in beautiful words, scepter and crown must tumble down, and in the dust be equal made with the poor scythe and spade. But to die of an unnatural and beastly death, as it has been the case with them, I can find no solace and peace. You can understand that I hate each and every German who has been connected with the Nazi ideology."
What it looks like to me is really the literary equivalent of those Russian nested dolls where you keep thinking you've got the last doll and you open and find yet one more tiny one inside.
Marjorie Kay reviewed Two Lives for the Christian Science Monitor.
You begin the book thinking, well, this is the story of his aunt and uncle and their two lives and how they became a couple. And then you read further and inside that you find, oh, really, this now looks like the story of Henny and the sufferings that she and her family went through and the sort of conscience-wringing that her friends went through in Germany. Through this series of letters, you're given this sort of unique perspective on the Holocaust. And then you get further beyond that and you find, oh no, there's actually another story in here, the story of how Henny and Shanti managed to put that behind them.
Vikram Seth has written about members of his family before, in his novel, A Suitable Boy. But he says he knew that the facts of this story, sometimes stranger than fiction, would have a greater impact as nonfiction.
For instance, take Shanti uncle being told to retreat from the front one day before his arm is blown off, and saying, oh no, I'll hang on for an extra day because my friends want to throw a party for me, and nothing's happened to me for a month, so nothing's going to happen to me tomorrow. And that is the day that, you know, the terrible thing took place. Or, for instance, the discovery of the trunk. Now, this is the stuff of sort of romantic novels. You know, cobweb-covered trunks are not discovered in attics unless you're writing some sort of gothic novel. But indeed, that was what happened.
Critic Marjorie Kay says Seth's 500-page memoir is like a series of long, rambling family visits.
It plods at times, and it doesn't allow you the luxury of knowing what each character is thinking at all times. In fact, there are major gaps. And yet, for me, that reflects real-life relationships. This is how it is. Even with the people that we come to know the best in our lives, often later, perhaps when it's too late to ask them, we realize that there were enormous things we never knew about them, and yet we knew them very well.
Vikram Seth says he was often frustrated by the gaps in Shanti and Henny's story that he couldn't fill in, but he says it was better to paint part of a picture than nothing at all.
One can eventually only see through a glass darkly, but I hope that the love and also, I would say, the courage of people who struggled under, I would say, insupportable losses, whether it's your country and your family, in the case of Henny, or whether it's your limb and your vocation and probably your future in the case of Shanti. These were typical, atypical people or ordinary, extraordinary people.
Vikram Seth says the value of his memoir also lies in the history of Shanti and Henny's times, which spanned the 20th century. Shanti died in 1998. Henny died 9 years earlier. For NPR News, I'm Tom Vitale in New York.
This is NPR News.